Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Metz.
Thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll go beyond the headlines with insight and analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping our future. Live or on demand, I'll bring you stories that keep you informed and ahead. And coming up on the program today, the auto sector is on edge amid fears of a looming jobs bloodbath. South Africans still squeezed even with lower borrowing costs. Plastic microbeads banned. Is this now sending a clear signal on pollution? And Standard Bank's boss on the race to turn capital into real infrastructure. It's Friday, the 5th of September. Now, Ford South Africa has announced it's going to shed something in the region of 500 jobs at its Silverton assembly plant in Pretoria, as well as its Struendael engine plant in the Eastern Cape. With hundreds of operators and even administrative staff affected, the company says it's aligning production with demand. But the trade union Solidarity is warning this could be the start of a wave of retrenchments right across the automotive sector. I don't need to tell you that is one of South Africa's biggest industrial employers. I'm joined now by Willie Venter from Solidarity. Willie, good morning to you. Ford is blaming, and I quote, market demand. Do you buy that, or is this cover for deeper problems, do you think?
Look, according to their notification that they send out to trade unions, they tabled the same reasons. I think on face value, we have to accept that for now. But during consultations, we will obviously dig deep. I think our concern leading up to communicating our bigger concern for the vehicle manufacturing industry is that for many years now, the vehicle manufacturers flagged quite a few problems, structural problems, that pressurized them in competing in the local market, but also export market. And we haven't seen any drastic or urgent intervention to try and resolve those problems. And we are not convinced that Ford is not also hampered by the same problems. So we cannot argue the facts in the notification yet, but we will endeavor to establish if there's anything deeper underlying during the consultation process. Because if that is the case, then we sit with a big problem.
And of course, none of this is helped by the Trump tariffs either.
Not at all. We know in the case of Ford, they don't export a lot of their vehicles to the US market. It's mostly to the European market and then neighboring countries to South Africa and then the local market. But the other manufacturers are definitely impacted by the US tariffs that they imposed. I've read this morning about Mercedes raising a concern about the tariffs impacting them and their exports in the C-Class passenger vehicles to the US. So we are not convinced that these structural problems do not also impact the Ford establishment. And we will definitely dig and see if there's such structural problems.
In fact, it's not just a Ford problem, as you rightly say. You're warning that this could be the start of an industry-wide jobs, even bloodbath. Do you have any sense at this point, does the union have any sense as to how many jobs potentially are at stake right now?
Well, just in the motor vehicle sector, I mean, I'm not 100% certain about the number of employees, but I mean, if Ford needs to close down, which we hope never happens, you're talking close to 5,000 employees that they employ. I mean, Mercedes raising the concern about the tariffs, they employ more than 2,500 employees in the Eastern Cape, and so forth and so forth. I mean, if you look at BMW, Volkswagen, Toyota, South Africa, they all export. I'm not 100% sure if what the percentage of exports to the US are for those manufacturers, but I assume it's pretty big. And if government does not do something to get a tariff policy in place or a tariff agreement in place with the USA to replace the AGOA agreement, we see that there will be a lot of job losses. These international companies will take their local manufacturing plants to other countries where it's easier and more cost-effective and more competitive to manufacture these vehicles. We've seen it with Goodyear South Africa's closure recently. I mean, Germany, there's 900 employees, 900 families now left without income. We understand that they've received very, very good severance packages, but that's like sticking a plaster on a much bigger problem. It was evident through the severance packages that Goodyear was adamant to take the manufacturing capacity out of South Africa, rather take the manufacturing to European countries and then import those finished goods back to South Africa because it's just more cost effective and there's a lot less red tape they have to deal with.
Willie, on a wider canvas, government responds or retorts by saying that it has an industrial policy in place. But the question is, has any of this actually shielded auto workers? Probably not.
I don't think so, Jeremy. It's one thing to say that we have to grow our industrial capacity, but if your policies and the application of those policies does not support the expansion of your industrialization, then what's the use of having such sentiments? We've seen in the companies and the notifications that we received from the wider manufacturing industry. We're talking across the new tire manufacturing industry, the new vehicle manufacturing industry, the steel manufacturing industry. All of those notifications indicate simple structural problems. So if President Ramaphosa indicates that he wants South Africa to be one big construction site, then something needs to change. Everybody's complaining about the high electricity tariffs imposed on the manufacturing industry, and it does not necessarily support industrial development or competitiveness, even for exports. All of them are complaining about Transnet's incapability of providing proper service. Also, there are high costs, trade policies that do not protect local manufacturing, does not support exports, etc. It does not even support investment. Then there's something seriously wrong, and we have to urgently get government to look at drastically changing those policies, or if you've got a policy for industrialization, implement it and support it so that we can get growth in the economy.
Willie, you don't feel that we're really on a hiding to nothing, given that so much pressure is coming from cheap imports and the government perhaps hasn't responded quickly enough?
We believe that that's one of the key factors in the steel industry, at least. And I mean, with Goodyear's closure recently, that's also one problem area that they highlighted, that they can simply not compete with cheap tire imports from the East, mainly China and India. They cannot compete with those prices whilst being subjected to high electricity and transport costs, for instance, here, which raises production costs. It's the same in the steel industry where dumping of cheap steels from the East is taking place, and government is not taking to it urgently to try and prevent the dumping of new tires, cheap steel imports. And I'm sure the recent rise or spike in imported vehicles, already manufactured vehicles, to the South African market also has a huge impact in the local market competitiveness with new vehicle manufacturers all over the place that are hampered by these costs and they cannot compete with those cheap imports.
Willie Venter, thank you very much indeed from the Trade Union Solidarity.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
The Q1 2025 Altron FinTech Household Resilience Index reveals a mixed picture of South African households' financial health amid economically challenging times. With the prime lending rate at 11% following the third repo rate cut in January, and despite some stabilization in credit costs, many households, I don't need to tell you, continue to face financial pressure due to high real interest rates and rising unemployment. So let's make some sense of the latest index. I'm in conversation with economist Dr. Rolf Botha, who compiles the document. Rolf, always good to talk to you. The recent cut in the repo rate to 7.5% and the prime lending rate at 11%, how is that influencing, in your opinion, household financial resilience? What's the picture that you're drawing?
Well, it's pretty clear from the index itself, which consists of 20 different indicators, all of which have a direct or indirect bearing on the household's ability to generate income and, of course, to spend the income or invested. And we can clearly see that your ratio of household wealth to income has increased by 4.7% year on year. The index in its totality has increased by 2.5% year on year, which is five times higher than the GDP, by the way. Household consumption expenditure has increased. These are all year on year figures I'm referring to. Salaries in the private sector also up by 1.6%. But it unfortunately it masks two realities. The one is that a large chunk of the increase is related to official pension fund lump sum payments from the two-pot system. Mm. So people have been putting their hands in the cookie jars. I hope they realize that they'll have to work harder, smarter, or longer, or a combination to make up for that. But certainly that has assisted the increase in household consumption expenditure. I do believe, however, that we must take cognizance of the admonition by Johan Gillitli, the MD of Altron FinTech, who has said that although rate cuts are pretty useful, far more aggressive monetary policy easing is essential to restore household financial stability, and especially to create jobs, because our unemployment rate is at an all-time high. Mm. And I fear that the Monetary Policy Committee of the Reserve Bank is not watching that indicator closely enough.
So some might call it restrictive, others might call it cautious, but what then does the MPC need to change in order to make things a little looser, a little easier, a little more flexible for households which, as you've outlined for me, are already under enormous pressure?
Well, it's quite straightforward, Jeremy. If you look at the recent wage increases in South Africa, wage settlements, it's just below 5% on average, according to the research at the Optimum Investment Group. You have administered prices increasing at between 5 and 10% on an annualized basis. And combined, we're talking about more than half of the inflation basket. So for the Reserve Bank to consider a 3% inflation point is the most ridiculous thing I've heard of, next to, of course, taking the prime rate to its highest level in 15 years until recently. The Reserve Bank must drop interest rates. If we go and look at the average real prime rate during the previous tenure of the previous governor, Jill Marcus, who became a colleague of mine at IBS, and she was the best governor we ever had, as far as I'm concerned, the average real prime rate, prime minus CPI, during her tenure was 3.4%. It is right now, as we speak, 7.5%, which, as Johan Gillitli has pointed out, is 118%, more than double the real cost of capital and of credit. It's no wonder the economy is not growing. It's the single biggest obstacle to short-term growth, in the short term, to growth and employment creation, is the excessively restrictive monetary policy, which has damaged this economy. And I'm involved in a research project to actually calculate that damage as we speak. And there's a nasty surprise waiting for the MPC in another couple of weeks' time.
What is the consequence then if the interest rate policy remains on the current conservative trajectory that you're criticizing?
Well, it's very serious. Jeremy, I cannot begin to explain to you. At the end of the first quarter, there were exactly as many formal sector jobs in this economy as people that were looking for jobs. If you use formal sector employment as your basis, then we have a 50%, 5-0 unemployment rate. The US has a 4% unemployment rate. We have been following US monetary policy. Why? It does not make any sense whatsoever. If I had been governor of the Reserve Bank, I would take a cue from Jill Marcus, and I would be a little bit more conservative, make the real prime rate, target that, make it 4% plus the CPI gives you a 7% prime rate, nominal prime rate. It's as easy as that, and they can do that by the stroke of a pen.
Can I put to you, Roelof, that maybe rates themselves can't just fix the problem? Are price pressures not largely administrative, particularly when you think of energy and logistics-driven issues? High rates, for instance, are not going to repair Transnet or Eskom, which remain the backbone, fundamental to the growth of our economy.
Yes, absolutely. But for us to first repair our infrastructure, which was decimated as a result of state capture, and it's amazing that some of the architects of state capture are actually now in parliament, which is a pity as far as I'm concerned. But to fix this and to expand this, which is desperately necessary, the private sector must become involved. Now, for them to get involved in capital formation, they would obviously also need some financial capital. And the cost of that is now 120%, as we speak, higher than it was on average during John Marcus's tenure. Mm. That is one of the reasons why we're not getting ahead. We need lower interest rates. We need interest rates that are commensurate with the what should be the economic priority in this country from a policy perspective, and that is to create jobs, and you can do that with infrastructure expansion.
Dr. Botha, let me come back to the index itself, if I can. Are there particular indicators within the study that maybe show the most significant changes in the quarter? And what would these trends suggest about future household financial stability?
Well, you know, the two-pot system has had a beneficial effect on the Altron FinTech Household Index, but it has had an adverse effect on, you know, the value of pension fund balances. So short-term, yes, that was good, but long-term, not such a good idea. Civil debt defaults, they've gone down quite dramatically, so that's a good sign. And unit trust assets, which is a proxy for the potential for dividend receipts from investments on the stock exchange, that showed an 8.7% year-on-year increase. I suppose listeners are aware that the JSE is doing pretty well. But what we need in the economy is for GDP to do pretty well and for us to create jobs. And it can be done. If the government can just resuscitate the RDP housing program, construction is the most labor-intensive sector in the economy, more so even than agriculture. There are so many things that we can do if we can just remove these layers and layers of bureaucracy and take the World Bank's advice in this roadmap that they've presented to government for sustained growth, which talks to this directly. They need to deregulate the economy and just put the transformation agenda on the back burner until we have created enough jobs, because that is the most effective way to combat poverty and inequality, is to create a formal sector job.
One economist that does not pull his punches, Dr. Roelof Botha, talking about the Q1 2025 Altron FinTech Household Resilience Index. Roelof, always appreciate your time and thank you very much indeed.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, plastic microbeads, once common, I understand, in face washes, body scrubs, and even toothpaste, are now banned in South Africa. They may have made our skin feel smooth, but scientists are warning they're devastating for rivers, oceans, and even our food chain. I want to discuss this in a little more detail. I'm joined now by Professor Anushka Rajkaran from the Department of Biodiversity and Conservation Biology at the University of the Western Cape. Professor, a very warm welcome to you. Maybe let's start with this. For listeners who may not know, what exactly are microbeads and why were they so popular?
So I'd like you to imagine rubbing grains of sugar or salt between your fingers. So you feel the roughness. That's how small microbeads are. And their uses were to exfoliate or scrub or to scour surfaces from household items or surface to anything from your skin and your teeth. And of course, a major difference between sugar and salt is that the microbeads are made out of plastics or polymers, the building blocks of plastics, and they don't dissolve or break down like sugar does in your coffee. Instead, they are flushed down the sink into our wastewater systems and then into the environments, either on land or into our aquatic systems. So it's the plastics the size of pinheads. We feel them, but we maybe don't see them.
Could you explain how such tiny particles then end up causing outsized damage?
Yes. So when we think about our microbeads, we can first think about them from an accumulation, meaning how many microbeads are in the environment, and of course, then also in our animals. And then we can think of them from a chemical point of view. So what are they made up of, and what are the hazards of those components? And we're starting to understand what the responses are of particular cells from different organs within humans, what are the health responses. And from an animal point of view, we're seeing that the microbeads can create a blockage. So many microbeads together can block different pathways within our animals and then trigger a response that could lead to either a decrease in survival, so by killing the animal, or a decrease in reproduction. So how successful is that animal in creating their young?
It sounds very serious. Do you think the health risks generally are still underestimated, though?
Yes, I believe so. So when scientists like myself, especially when we work in the environment, a lot of our work is based on just quantifying or knowing how much is in the environment. We haven't started to work on what are the impacts on different kinds of animals. But luckily, we can look at the growing body of literature from international universities, where some of the experiments are to feed these microbeads to the animals and then look at the responses. So that's something that as a scientific community, we can still add to by looking at the animals and even some of the plants that are in our specific environment.
Professor, at this point, are current methods for detecting microplastics anywhere near accurate enough, though?
So I'm glad you brought up the word microplastics. So it's important to say what are microplastics. So microbeads are just one component of microplastics. And these microplastics are anything smaller than 5 millimeters. And of course, that goes into the invisible range. So when we try to quantify the microplastics, we would either collect a sample of soil, a sample of water, or a particular animal. For our animals, we would break down or digest that animal and then look under a microscope to see if we can find the microplastics. And then what we do is we take it an extra step and we use very specialized machines that will tell us which polymers are based in those, are found in those plastics. For our sand and our water, we use a buoyancy method where we add salt to the sample and then our plastics would float out. So it's quite a, it can be quite a simple method to extract microplastics, but what we find with the microbeads is that we are probably underestimating the amount of microbeads because they look very similar to sand. Sand particles, and therefore we may not be picking them up as much as we should.
It's my understanding, and you'll correct me if I've misread this, that other countries have gone a lot further, and the suggestion is that we should be, as a country, targeting microplastics more broadly over and above microbeads.
Yes, that's correct. So if we look at the current microbead ban, I think I want to say up front that any legislation that's going to help us to stem the flow of microbeads into the environment is great. But as a country, we can definitely move a lot further than that. Our samples are finding very high concentrations of microfibers. And of course, some microfibers can be natural, like cotton, whereas other microfibers are very much made up of plastic polymers. So sometimes in our samples, more than 90% of the microplastics are actually fibers. And those fibers are coming from us washing our clothes in our washing machines, and that wastewater then goes into our wastewater treatments, and then it may then go into the environment. So there needs to be a much greater overview of microplastics. And we can start off by banning even our plastic bags because those fragment into microplastics. We can start to use more glass bottles instead of our plastic bottles. And we need to start doing a lot more research in how we can increase the efficiency of our washing machines to decrease this flow of microfibers into the environment.
And Professor, just a quick answer in conclusion. I would suggest to you that enforcement is often the weak link.
Yes.
Who should be policing this ban?
That's a very good question. I think the government has to play a very important role, especially the scientific members of the government. As scientists, we need to standardize the methods, especially for our microbeads. But for any legislation, the implementation is critical. And the support to the companies that are now going to have to find alternatives to the plastic microbeads is also important. So it's got to be at multiple levels. That we look at this particular problem. And there are alternatives. There are natural products that can be used to replace the synthetic microbeads.
Thank you very much indeed. I've been in conversation with Professor Anusha Rajkaran from the Department of Biodiversity and Conservation Biology at the University of the Western Cape. Professor, thank you.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, the B20 this week unveiling its set of finance and infrastructure recommendations, proposals aimed at unlocking investment, strengthening partnerships, and fixing bottlenecks that hold back growth. All of this, of course, ahead of the G20 summit later this year. But what are the key priorities, and how is all of this going to be turned into action? I was joined by Standard Bank Group Chief Executive Officer Sim Shabalala, who chairs the B20 Finance and Infrastructure Task Force.
From a finance and infrastructure perspective, Jeremy, the single biggest recommendation is we need to close the gap between the amount of money necessary to put in place transformative infrastructure in the world, which is, you know, the world spends about $3 trillion a year for that purpose. In the case of Africa, we need roughly $170 billion a year. The gap in the case of Africa is $85 billion. In other words, we can only raise 85 of that 170. And so the single biggest recommendation would be, let us put together mechanisms that help us to bridge that gap. Perhaps in our conversation, we can have to break that down.
Well, let's look at some of those key mechanisms then. What is most important in kickstarting that process?
Jeremy, there are three broad things that the world needs to do. The first one is we need to put in place mechanisms that support transformative infrastructure. So in the case of Africa, it's roads, it's bridges, it's dams, it is data centers, it is giving people access to the electricity grid, it is distribution of electricity, it's transmission lines, and it's generation, whether it be fossil fuel driven or driven by solar and wind. The second set of recommendations that we will be making will be to say, well, we need to improve access to capital. Now, there are about $500 billion globally needed. In the case of Africa, 170, the gap is 85 billion. And so we need to make sure that we build investment capacity. We need to change the rules that make it possible for public, private, and philanthropic institutions, giving them the ability to advance money into these projects. And again, I'd like to come back to what those changing rules specifically entail to get money into these projects. And then the third thing that we need to do is we need to make sure that the flows of money from investors get into the real economy and find themselves into the hands of SMEs. Because what typically happens in these projects is that the investors put the money into the projects, but they only land in the hands of large corporations. So that third recommendation or set of recommendations suggests how you get the money right through the economy into the hands of SMEs. Perhaps we stop there.
Let's talk about the trickle down, which is critical, and also the rules, which are absolutely important. But how difficult is it to set priorities in terms of that big list that you've got? It's big, it's all encompassing.
In our case, perhaps I could give you an example of the experience of the conversations in this B20 process. I'm the chairman of the Finance and Infrastructure Task Force. My deputy is Nomisa Fuzile, who's the deputy for the purposes of this project. I've got 8 co-chairs. They come from throughout the world. Daniel Pinto, who's the vice chairman of JP Morgan Chase, Anne Richards, who is the CEO of Prudential, John Denton, who is the secretary general of the International Chamber of Commerce based in Paris. And then we've got several other people, including Strive Masiwa, Terry Dew, Benjamin Hung, based in Hong Kong. In addition to that 8 set of co-chairs who are deliberating in our forum, you've got 170 members of the task force, which participated in 4 sets of meetings, which we chaired to deliberate on these issues. These people came from all over the world. The largest grouping actually came from South Africa. The second largest grouping came from the United States, then Zimbabwe, the United Kingdom, and so forth. And we met several times to narrow down the issues necessary to unlock that 3 trillion rand that I was referring to. And we arrived at a set of recommendations. In the area of, you know, the cost of capital debate, how to get this money into these projects, We've made several recommendations, which you might want me to talk about, because that gives you an example of, firstly, how the debate happened and the concrete outcomes of those debates.
Well, let's lift the curtain as far as that's concerned. I'd be interested to know how those deliberations took place and how difficult it was to achieve the degree of consensus, because you want consensus, but you also want contestation.
Indeed. So the issue around cost of capital, which is very salient, and it's salient in this discussion because right here in South Africa, the ratings agencies are in South Africa reviewing South Africa. So I think it's a very, very important part of the discussion and the debate, the issue of cost of capital. Our contention has been that there's lots of evidence that these ratings agencies don't fully understand African countries. And as a result of that, they tend to assess them as riskier than they actually are. These are contention. We say that when you look at how they price African sovereign debt, the sovereign debt of South Africa, for example, we've shown statistically that their assessment of sub-Saharan issuers is often up to 4 risk grades worse than the levels implied by the fundamentals. So the economic fundamentals, the institutions, how the country works relative to the rating given is 4 times worse than it ought to be. In the case of South Africa, they rate us BB- junk status, whereas we suggested we should be BBB, which is investment grade. We've shown it statistically. And what we've been arguing to them that if you were to rate South Africa as BBB, as I'm arguing, our sovereign spread, in other words, the interest rate that we pay effectively would be 70 to 50 basis points, 50 to 70 basis points lower than it currently is. That would release, within a period of about 3 years, 50 billion rand a year. We would save 50 billion rand a year in interest costs for South Africa if that happened. So in our engagements, in our B20 task force, we've got the ratings agencies and we have engaged them. In the process, we've had people differing in opinion. They've said, no, but the methodology works. Some have said, no, the methodology doesn't work. What's the data supporting that methodology works? What is the data that supports the technical structure of those models that they use? What are the inputs, debt to GDP ratios, etc.? What do they look at when they evaluate its governance? Do they use the World Bank governance indicators? If they do, we're saying, but they're often inaccurate. Those indicators, for example, rate South Africa very similar to Papua New Guinea. In which world is South Africa similarly rated to Papua New Guinea in terms of governance, the quality of institutions and so forth? And so we've persuaded people that this needs to be rethought, how the ratings agencies think. For example, they have been responsive as a consequence of some of these debates. They are now more represented on the African continent. In the case of Moody's, you saw that they bought an African-based ratings agency. S&P released a statement a couple of months ago saying that they were increasing their representation in South Africa, which is good. In that context, we've also said governments need to get their act together. Perhaps we might want to delve into what that means, but it's not just the ratings agencies that need to get their act together in terms of the cost of capital, as suggested in our recommendations, so must government.
The full conversation with Sim Shabalala drops on Monday in the Mandates and Megaphones podcast. And that's where we are going to leave it. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We are here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.